of all those people on the environment. Others were worried about that, too. In 1979, Tanton started the Federation for American Immigration Reform with the help of investor Warren Buffett and Democratic Senator Eugene McCarthy. The group argued that higher population levels would lead to more consumption, more pollution, and more environmental degradation. Tanton imagined that others like him would join the effort to slow mass immigration. In the words of a New York Times profile, Tanton, quote, hoped to enlist unions concerned about wage erosion, environmentalists concerned about pollution and sprawl, and blacks concerned about competition for housing, jobs, and schools. That's not what happened. Instead, the Southern Poverty Law Center, which fraudulently poses as a civil rights group used by the left to smear its opposition, devoted an entire page on its website to suggesting Tanton was a Nazi. Tanton has for decades been at the heart of the white nationalist scene, the SPLC charged, providing no evidence. Tanton, who lives in a nursing home and is suffering from Parkinson's disease, could do little to defend himself. Warren Buffett was gone by this point, reinvented as an advocate for a borderless world. Major environmental groups didn't say a word to defend Tanton either. Even executives at the Sierra Club, which Tanton had long supported, refused to speak up on his behalf. They'd changed their views on immigration, too. For years, the Sierra Club had articulated a zero population growth position. Immigration to the U.S. should be no greater than that which will permit achievement of population stabilization in the U.S. That's how the club put it in 1989. A few years later, a California investment fund billionaire named David Gelbaum began giving money to the group, ultimately at least $200 million. Gelbaum was a pro-immigration activist who had spent heavily in an effort to defeat Proposition 187 in California. When the initiative passed anyway, Gelbaum funded the court challenge that ultimately struck it down. Under pressure from Gelbaum, the Sierra Club radically changed its position on immigration. A battle within the organization ensued. Among the board members who objected to the change was the former Democratic governor of Colorado, Richard Lamb, and Frank Morris, the former executive director of the Congressional Black Caucus Foundation. In 2004, the New York Times quoted a Southern Poverty Law Center official who suggested that anyone who opposed the Sierra Club's new support for open borders was in league with racists and white nationalists. Morris, who was black, was shocked by the slur. To have this considered a position as a front for racists and Nazis is beyond the pale, he wrote. The paper issued a correction of sorts. Mr. Morris disputes those characterizations, saying his support for limiting immigration reflects concerns among African Americans and others that unchecked immigration had hurt their economic opportunities. But the damage was done. One of America's most powerful environmental organizations now supported mass immigration. In 2013, the group came out in favor of Barack Obama's amnesty orders. What did amnesty have to do with the environment? As the Sierra Club spokesman explained to Politico, illegal immigrants are, quote, the most adversely affected by pollution. He did not explain what that meant. The Sierra Club's position on immigration seems to become more activist every year. In 2016, the Texas chapter of the group refused to participate in an Earth Day festival because it included participants who wanted tighter border controls. The Austin American Statesman, which first reported the story, dutifully noted that anti-immigration organizations were connected to white nationalists through their ties to John Tanton. We consider them hate groups, explained Sierra Club State Director Reggie James. It's Earth Day. It's not this side of the border day. By redefining immigration as a moral issue, elites have shut down debate over its costs. That's helpful for them, since for the affluent, immigration has few costs and many upsides. Low-skilled immigrants don't compete in upscale job markets. Not many recent arrivals from El Salvador are becoming lawyers or green energy lobbyists. An awful lot of them are becoming housekeepers. Mass immigration makes household help affordable. This is one of the main reasons elites support it. From the 1800s through the 1950s, maids, nannies, gardeners, and other domestic help were ubiquitous in upper-middle-class households. Economic prosperity gradually eliminated the huge pool of unskilled labor that filled those jobs. But modern immigration policy has revived America's servant class. Immigrants now fill countless jobs as nannies, gardeners, cooks, and housekeepers. For employers, the best part of the new arrangement is that there's no guilt attached. Let's say you lived in an affluent household in Boston in 1910. You've got help at home, everyone in your neighborhood does. The problem is your servants are Irish. They may do a fine job making breakfast and ironing your sheets, but you can never quite relax. These are people who speak your language and look like you. At some point, you may wonder, why is someone who could be my cousin cleaning my toilet? It's uncomfortable. Third world immigration solves this problem. When your housekeeper is a peasant from Honduras, there's no reason to feel bad about it. You don't have to wonder about the details of her life outside of work. You can barely communicate with her. She may be cleaning your floors for minimum wage or less while your children travel abroad, but you're not exploiting her, just the opposite. You're giving her a hand up, allowing her to participate in the American dream. If she's here legally, maybe you help get her a green card. Yes, you've got an awful lot of power over her, but you're doing the right thing, and you can tell your friends about it at dinner. You're not like some Saudi prince or 19th century plutocrat taking advantage of a helpless peon for your own comfort. You're compassionate. You're the hero of this story. It's the perfect arrangement. You get to feel virtuous for having a housekeeper. She walks the dog while you're at SoulCycle. You can see why affluent moms tended to hate Donald Trump and his talk about building a wall. For Americans in the top 20% of income distribution, mass immigration is one of the best things that ever happened. Cheap help, obedient employees, more interesting restaurants, and all without guilt. There's no downside, at least none that you personally experience. You don't take the bus or use the emergency room for health care or send your kids to overpopulated public schools that have canceled gym and music to pay for ESL because half the kids can't speak English. The New York Times tells you that immigrants are reviving dying towns all over America. It's easy to imagine that only bigots would oppose open borders. Occasionally, you'll read a story about stagnant wages in the Rust Belt or about high levels of black teen unemployment. As someone who took Econ 101 in college, you might wonder if immigration plays a role in that. You know about supply and demand, so you understand that an overabundance of anything causes its value to fall. That's why the fracking boom crashed oil prices. It's why printing money causes inflation. It's why sand is cheap. So does the same hold true for labor markets? No, your neighbors assure you. Immigration is the one exception to the most basic law of economics. It increases the size of the economic pie, allowing everyone to benefit. It's like magic. You're happy to believe that. Over time, you find your attitudes about the working class changing. You think of yourself as a champion of the little guy, but who's really the underdog here? The unemployed machinist in Toledo? He's fat, smokes cigarettes, and gets by on disability payments for a back injury that may or may not be legitimate. He likely voted for Donald Trump. You don't even want to know his views on gay marriage. Compare him to your gardener. Now, there's a guy you can admire. He somehow made it from Oaxaca to your front yard, enduring risks and privations you can only imagine. And yet he never complains, at least not in a language that you can speak. He shows up on time, does a fine job, and doesn't charge much. Every month he sends money back to his family in Mexico. Why is he not more impressive than the reactionary machinist in Ohio? He is, of course. Once you recognize that, your perspectives change. America's lower classes look less like fellow citizens in need of uplift and more like damaged raw materials worthy of replacement if they aren't measuring up. Your support for social improvement efforts, the ones that previous generations of elites devoted their lives to, begins to wane. Public schools, for example. Sure, they're bad. You know that. That's why you don't send your kids. But can we really improve them? You're starting to wonder. Maybe it's just simpler to import a new wave of low-skilled workers from abroad. They certainly have better attitudes. Even at the higher end of the income scale, this is true. You love the idea of retraining out-of-work Michigan auto workers to code software, but let's be realistic. Are they actually capable of that? It might just be easier to hire coders in Bangalore and bring them here. They'd be grateful for the chance. And isn't that the point of America anyway, to give opportunity to the world? There's a poem on the Statue of Liberty that says something like that. It's basically in the Constitution. Once you start thinking like this, it doesn't take long to run out of empathy for your fellow Americans. In 2016, a study by the Centers for Disease Control and Prevention determined that the life expectancy of native-born Americans in many parts of the country was in decline. People are dying younger, and for reasons that were largely preventable, cirrhosis, diabetes, drug overdoses, nothing like this had ever happened in American history. As a matter of social policy, it was a disaster. If your people are dying younger, you are failing. How did Washington respond? With a shrug. There was a short flurry of concerned op-eds in the first week or two after the CDC report appeared. After that, silence. It is impossible to imagine a similar reaction if the same thing were happening to Syrian refugees. They came here for a better life, but instead met an early death? That wouldn't stand. There would be comprehensive news coverage of the tragedy, frothy editorials, a series of emotional speeches from the floor of the House, followed by an armada of congressional task forces that in the end would likely blame racism. Our ruling class would be upset. They'd consider it, correctly, a stain on the conscience of the country. Immigrants matter to elites. America's struggling middle class, not so much. As it happens, many employers feel the same way. It's hard to blame the Chamber of Commerce for supporting unrestrained immigration. Businesses benefit from it, at least in the short term. Capitalists push for what's best for markets. But what happens when nobody in power takes the opposing view? We don't need to speculate. At a closed-door speech in 2013, Hillary Clinton told a group of Brazilian bankers, quote, "My dream is a hemispheric common market with open trade and open borders." Suddenly, the liberal position and the conservative position were indistinguishable. It was the beneficiaries of cheap labor against everyone else. Rulers versus serfs. Chapter 3. Foolish Wars. One thing that every late-stage ruling class has in common is a high tolerance for mediocrity. Standards decline, the edges fray, but nobody in charge seems to notice. They're happy in their sinecures and getting richer. In a culture like this, there is no penalty for being wrong. The talentless prosper, rising inexorably toward positions of greater power and breaking things along the way. It happened to the Ottomans. Max Boot is living proof that it's happening in America. Boot is a professional foreign policy expert, a job category that doesn't exist outside of a select number of cities. Boot has degrees from Berkeley and Yale and is a fellow at the Council on Foreign Relations. He's written a number of books and countless newspaper columns on foreign policy and military history. The International Institute for Strategic Studies, an influential British think tank, describes Boot as, quote, "one of the world's leading authorities on armed conflict." None of this, it turns out, means anything. The professional requirements for being one of the world's leading authorities on armed conflict do not include relevant experience with armed conflict. Leading authorities on the subject don't need a track record of wise assessments or accurate predictions. All that's required are the circular recommendations of fellow credential holders. If other leading authorities on armed conflict induct you into their ranks, you're in. That's good news for Max Boot. Boot first became famous in the weeks after 9/11 for outlining a response that the Bush administration seemed to read like a script, virtually word for word. While others were debating whether Kandahar or Kabul ought to get the first round of American bombs, Boot was thinking big. In October 2001, he published a piece in the Weekly Standard titled "The Case for American Empire." Quote, "The September 11 attack was a result of insufficient American involvement and ambition," Boot wrote. "The solution is to be more expansive in our goals and more assertive in their implementation." In order to prevent more terror attacks in American cities, Boot called for a series of U.S.-led revolutions around the world, beginning in Afghanistan and moving swiftly to Iraq. "Once we have deposed Saddam, we can impose an American-led international regency in Baghdad to go along with the one in Kabul," Boot wrote. "To turn Iraq into a beacon of hope for the oppressed peoples of the Middle East, now that would be a historic war aim. Is this an ambitious agenda? Without a doubt. Does America have the resources to carry it out? Also, without a doubt." In retrospect, Boot's words are painful to read, like a love letter from a marriage that ended in divorce. Iraq remains a smoldering mess. The Afghan war is still in progress, close to 20 years in. For perspective, Napoleon Bonaparte seized control of France, crowned himself emperor, defeated four European coalitions against him, invaded Russia, lost, was defeated and exiled, returned, and was defeated and exiled a second time, all in less time than the United States has spent trying to turn Afghanistan into a stable country. Things haven't gone as planned. What's remarkable is despite all the failure and waste and deflated expectations, defeats that have stirred self-doubt in the hardiest of men, Boot has remained utterly convinced of the virtue of his original predictions. Certainty is a prerequisite for leading authorities in armed conflict. In the spring of 2003, with the war in Iraq underway, Boot began to consider new countries to invade. He quickly identified Syria and Iran as plausible targets, the latter because it was, quote, less than 2 years from building a nuclear bomb. North Korea made Boot's list as well. Then Boot became more ambitious. Saudi Arabia could use a democracy, he decided. Quote, if the U.S. armed forces made such short work of a hardened goon like Saddam Hussein, imagine what they could do to the soft and sybaritic Saudi royal family, Boot wrote. The Bush administration apparently ignored the suggestion, but Boot was undeterred. 5 years later, in a piece for the Wall Street Journal, he advocated for the military occupation of Pakistan and Somalia. The only potential problem, he predicted, was unreasonable public opposition to new wars. Ragtag guerrillas have proven dismayingly successful in driving out or neutering international peacekeeping forces, he wrote. Think of American and French troops blown up in Beirut in 1983 or the Black Hawk Down incident in Somalia in 1993. Too often, when outside states do agree to send troops, they are so fearful of casualties that they impose rules of engagement that preclude meaningful action, end quote. In other words, the tragedy of foreign wars isn't that Americans die, but that too few Americans are willing to die. To solve this problem, Boot recommended recruiting foreign mercenaries. Quote, the military would do well today to open its ranks not only to legal immigrants, but also to illegal ones, he wrote in the LA Times. When foreigners get killed fighting for America, he noted, there's less political backlash at home. American forces, documented or not, never occupied Pakistan. But by 2011, Boot had another war in mind. Gaddafi must go, Boot declared in the Weekly Standard. In Boot's telling, the Libyan dictator had become a threat to the American homeland. The only way this crisis will end, the only way we and our allies can achieve our objectives in Libya, is to remove Gaddafi from power. Containment won't suffice. In the end, Gaddafi was removed from power, with ugly and long-lasting consequences. Boot was on to the next invasion. By late 2012, he was once again promoting attacks on Syria and Iran, as he had 9 years before. In a piece for the New York Times, Boot laid out 5 reasons to intervene in Syria now. Not surprisingly, all of them were simple and compelling. Overthrowing the Assad regime, Boot predicted, would, quote, diminish Iran's influence in the region, influence that had grown dramatically since the Bush administration took Boot's advice and overthrew Saddam Hussein, Iran's most powerful counterbalance. To doubters concerned about a complex new war, Boot promised the Syria intervention would be conducted with little risk. Days later, Boot wrote a separate piece for Commentary magazine, calling for American bombing of Iran. It was a busy week, even by the standards of a leading authority on armed conflict. In the Commentary piece, Boot conceded that, quote, it remains a matter of speculation what Iran would do in the wake of such strikes. He didn't seem worried. Listed in one place, Boot's many calls for U.S.-led war around the world come off as a parody of mindless warlike noises, something you might write if you got mad at a country while drunk. I'll invade you! Republicans in Washington didn't find any of it amusing. They were impressed. Boot became a top foreign policy advisor to John McCain's presidential campaign in 2008, to Mitt Romney's in 2012, and to Marco Rubio in 2016. He continued to churn out well-received articles for Foreign Policy magazine, The Wall Street Journal, USA Today, and The Washington Post. Everything changed when Trump won the Republican nomination. Trump had never heard of the International Institute for Strategic Studies. He had no idea Max Boot was a leading authority on armed conflict. Trump was running against more armed conflicts. He had no interest in invading Pakistan. Boot hated him. As Trump found himself accused of improper ties to Vladimir Putin, Boot agitated for more aggressive confrontation with Russia. Boot demanded larger weapon shipments to Ukraine. He called for effectively expelling Russia from the global financial system, a move that might be construed as an act of war against a nuclear-armed power. The stakes were high, but with signature aplomb, Boot assured readers it was, quote, hard to imagine the Russian government would react badly to the provocation. Those who disagreed, Boot dismissed as cheerleaders for Putin and the mullahs in Iran. As Boot's posture on Russia became more reckless and bellicose, his stock in the Washington foreign policy establishment rose. In 2018, he was hired by the Washington Post as a columnist. The paper's announcement cited Boot's, quote, expertise on armed conflict. A generation ago, it would have been hard to imagine a newspaper like the Washington Post celebrating Max Boot. Liberals were stridently anti-war. Opposing armed conflict was central to their identity. They hated violence. They visualized world peace. Liberals imagined a day when schools were fully funded, but the Pentagon would be forced to hold bake sales because war was not the answer, and an eye for an eye made the whole world blind. Those were actual slogans, and you heard them a lot. Liberals composed songs about peace, held festivals and symposia to celebrate it. Bumper stickers with anti-war slogans festooned the back of virtually every Volkswagen on every street in every college town in America. Mahatma Gandhi and Martin Luther King were revered on the left, not just because they were for civil rights and against colonialism, but because both were outspoken pacifists, something that's rarely noted today. To be liberal meant to oppose violence, especially violence committed by the U.S. military. More than anything else, liberals were turned against war by the country's experience in Vietnam. Unlike any American war before or since, Vietnam demonstrated the horror, the futility, and ruin wrought by a conflict begun without domestic consensus or clear objectives. Americans were horrified by tens of thousands of military deaths and by the sight of young men drafted to go fight in a poor, distant country that posed no obvious threat to the United States. The military leaders promised the final victory was imminent. The war dragged on for more than a decade. Worst of all, it wasn't always clear that America held the moral high ground. South Vietnam's corrupt, autocratic government didn't seem worth defending. Atrocities like the 1968 My Lai massacre of 347 Vietnamese civilians shook the public's faith in the project while handing easy propaganda victories to America's opponents. After several years, Americans broadly turned against Vietnam, and liberals led that charge. During the 1968 election, Senator Eugene McCarthy challenged Lyndon Johnson from a nearly pacifist position, arguing not that the war couldn't be won, but that winning wasn't worth it. I am concerned that the administration seems to have set no limits to the price it's willing to pay for military victory, McCarthy said. His campaign was disorganized and underfunded, but the resonance of his message was enough to convince LBJ to drop out of the race. 4 years later, another anti-war Democrat managed to win the nomination, Senator George McGovern. He'd flown 35 bombing missions against the Nazis in a B-24. He couldn't be dismissed as a weakling afraid to draw blood. At the 1972 Democratic Convention that summer, McGovern promised to withdraw the U.S. from Vietnam immediately. Within 90 days of my inauguration, he said, every American soldier and every American prisoner will be out of the jungle and out of their cells and then home in America where they belong. The message failed. The McGovern campaign lost all but a single state in the general election to Richard Nixon. McGovern didn't reassess. If anything, he hardened his position. Before leaving the race, McGovern made the case for what might now be described as an America-first foreign policy. Quote, this is also the time to turn away from excessive preoccupation overseas to the rebuilding of our own nation. It would be 44 years before another presidential candidate made that point as forcefully, and he was a Republican. 4 years after that, Jimmy Carter became the only anti-war Democrat ever to win the presidency, riding a wave of anti-incumbent rage after Watergate. For all of his failings, Carter made good on his promise to keep U.S. troops out of harm's way. Depending on how you measure it, Carter may have been the only president in our history not to preside over a war. Only 8 American servicemen died in action during his administration, killed accidentally during a failed attempt to rescue American hostages in Iran. Politically, it didn't matter. Carter lost after a term, drowned in the Reagan tsunami he helped create. Personally, Carter was an unappealing figure, sanctimonious and nasty. As an executive, he conveyed indecision and incompetence. Even his strengths looked like weaknesses. When Carter bragged about keeping America out of war, it seemed his real motive was self-doubt. He was hesitant to use force because he didn't trust American power. Certainly, many of his fellow liberals felt that way. Even at its peak, liberal anti-war rhetoric was never entirely coherent. Liberals didn't hate all wars, just those in which the United States projected its will abroad. Nobody ever said that out loud, but it was evident. Liberals were horrified by Nixon's bombing of Cambodia. They said nothing when the communist government of Vietnam invaded the same country a few years later. They complained about American military bases in Italy, but they rarely mentioned the fact that Eastern Europe was occupied by Soviet troops. And of course, for pacifists, they seem strangely attracted to Cuban leaders and military fatigues. Liberals were never very consistent about where they stood on war, mostly because their positions were rooted in emotion rather than reason. But if their complaints about American imperialism were frequently childish, they nevertheless managed to make a couple of valid points. First, war is destructive. It kills people. Wars flatten cities, hobble economies, topple civilizations, and upend ancient ways of doing things, often forever. In war, children always die. None of this is hidden knowledge. Nobody would deny that war destroys. But it's easy to forget it anyway. Look up any speech by a political leader ushering his country into conflict, and you'll notice how nonspecific the descriptions are. It's always a battle for something abstract, like freedom or sovereignty. If politicians acknowledge that soldiers will be killed at all, it's only to extol their bravery and highlight the sheer glory of the endeavor. In speeches, war is never a bloody slog where 18-year-old boys get castrated by landmines, blasted apart by grenades, or pointlessly massacred in friendly fire accidents, though that's exactly what it is. Liberals reminded America of that. Yes, they were hysterical, inconsistent, and simplistic, often motivated by a dislike of their own country. But on a basic level, they were right. War is not the answer. It is a means to an end, and a very costly one. The second point that liberals made, often without knowing it, is that war is complicated. Once a conflict starts, there is no predicting what will happen or for how long. Violence tends to create chain reactions that move in unpredictable directions. On an unexceptional June morning in 1914, a second-string Austrian nobleman was murdered by a Serbian terrorist in Sarajevo. In response, Austria prepared to attack Serbia. Russia, in turn, decided to defend Serbia. Germany supported its ally Austria, France supported Russia, Great Britain somehow became involved, and soon a small war over a single nobleman's death had sucked in every European great power. Early on, commanders for both sides anticipated a short, triumphant conflict. The German Kaiser told his men they would be home before the leaves fell from the trees. Instead, the continent was shredded by 4 years of mass killing. More than 16 million people died. By the time World War I ended, four great empires with centuries-old monarchies had been destroyed. Wholly invented countries had risen in their place. Communism, previously a fringe ideology, held absolute control of Russia. Almost every significant conflict since, including World War II and the War on Terror, had its roots in what began that day in 1914. All the aftershocks of the death of a single minor nobleman bleeding out in the streets of Sarajevo. America has been granted no exception to the law of unintended consequences. In 1979, the Soviets invaded Afghanistan. Ronald Reagan came to power the next year, pledging to do something about it, and soon did. By sending aid and weapons to the Afghan resistance, Reagan helped weaken the Russian position in Afghanistan and ultimately the Soviet Union itself. Democrats fought him on the policy from the beginning. Republicans accused the liberals of being effectively pro-Soviet, and some of them were. Yet decades later, you've got to wonder how wise it was to arm Muslim extremists waging a holy war in Southwest Asia. Both Osama bin Laden and Taliban founder Mullah Omar got their first taste of warfare in the Afghan Mujahideen. Ironically, though, by the time it became clear that America had played a leading role in training its own enemies, liberals were in no position to complain. By that point, they were nearly as pro-war as the Republicans. The 1988 presidential campaign turned out to be the end of liberal pacifism. If you had to identify a moment of death, it would be the day the Dukakis campaign released video of its candidate riding in a tank with his helmet askew. An ad designed to show voters that Mike Dukakis wasn't a dopey peacenik had instead revealed the opposite. He was precisely that, an effete college professor type who didn't know which end of the gun the bullet came out of. Dukakis couldn't keep you safe. He probably didn't even want to. Within weeks, he blew a 17-point lead and lost to George H.W. Bush. From the sidelines in Little Rock, Bill Clinton was watching carefully. Clinton was a longtime peacenik himself, a Vietnam draft dodger who worked for the 1972 McGovern campaign, along with his wife Hillary. But he wasn't stupid. He understood that Democrats kept losing in part because voters perceived them as weak. He vowed not to repeat that mistake. In the middle of the 1992 New Hampshire primary campaign, when candidates were working 20-hour days and not a minute was unscheduled, Clinton took a break to fly back to Arkansas in order to preside over the lethal injection of a convicted murderer named Ricky Ray Rector. Rector was so profoundly brain damaged from a self-inflicted gunshot wound, it's not clear he knew he was about to die. After finishing his final meal, Rector asked the guards if he could save his dessert for later. Rival campaigns denounced the execution as inhumane. Clinton ignored them, and in November, he won the general election. The lesson was clear, and Clinton as president soon applied it to foreign policy. When he took office, Clinton inherited a several thousand troop humanitarian mission in Somalia, first deployed by President Bush. Clinton didn't simply continue the mission, he expanded it, deploying hundreds of U.S. special forces to battle Somali warlords. Clinton withdrew American forces only after 19 U.S. troops were killed. Criticism came not from liberals in his own party, but from Republicans. The experience was painful, but it did not halt future foreign interventions. In 1994, Clinton dispatched Marines to Haiti in order to topple the regime there. The following year, Clinton sent air power to intervene in the Bosnian War. He later deployed more than 16,000 troops to the region. In 1999, the United States bombed Yugoslavia as part of the Kosovo War, and again, thousands of troops arrived as peacekeepers in the aftermath. Clinton sent cruise missiles into both Sudan and Afghanistan as well. Clinton's most militant posture was reserved for Iraq, which the U.S. military bombed numerous times throughout his presidency. By the end of Clinton's second term, the United States was bombing Iraq an average of three times a week at the cost of more than $1 billion a year. After he left office, Clinton reflected that his main regret was that he hadn't been interventionist enough. He'd wanted to send American troops to Rwanda. Politically, the decision to become a pro-war party paid huge dividends for Democrats. From 1968 through 1988, Democrats decisively lost five presidential elections and narrowly won another. Since Clinton took the party back in a hawkish direction, the Democrats have lost the popular vote only once, in 2004. For the country, however, there was a downside. With both parties aligned on the wisdom of frequent military intervention abroad, no one was left to make the countercase. As a result, America has remained in a state of almost permanent war. One week after the World Trade Center fell, Congress voted to give President George W. Bush the authority to use military force against, quote, nations, organizations, or persons he determines planned, authorized, committed, or aided the terrorist attacks that occurred on September 11, 2001. The law was utterly open-ended. There was no expiration date. No country or terror organization was mentioned by name. The president had congressional approval to do essentially whatever he wanted. Only a single member of Congress in either chamber voted against it, and she was a flake from Berkeley, California, an old anti-war liberal. Even her fellow Democrats mocked her. There was now a bipartisan consensus on war, and it extended into the next conflict, Iraq. Indeed, the predicate for that war had been laid by the previous administration, which hyped the threats of Saddam's weapons of mass destruction program. Quote, no one has done what Saddam Hussein has done or is thinking of doing, Clinton's Secretary of State Madeleine Albright told an audience at a town hall meeting at Ohio State University in 1998. He is producing weapons of mass destruction, and he is qualitatively and quantitatively different from other dictators. When some in the room expressed skepticism, Albright attacked their character. I'm really surprised that people feel they need to defend the rights of Saddam Hussein, she said. At least one person in the crowd wasn't intimidated. You're not answering my question, Madam Albright, he yelled. Albright's response? As a former university professor, I suggest, sir, that you study carefully what American foreign policy is. Every one of the violations has been pointed out on what is not right, and I would be happy to spend 50 minutes with you after the forum to explain it. She never did. Nor did Albright explain how exactly Saddam Hussein was qualitatively and quantitatively different from other strongmen around the world. She didn't need to. Everyone back in Washington already agreed with her. In the fall of 2002, a total of 77 senators voted in favor of the Iraq War resolution. This included the majority of Democrats and 100% of the party's rising stars. Two future presidential candidates who voted for the war, John Kerry and Hillary Clinton, also happened to be future secretaries of state. The future vice president, Joe Biden, voted for it, as did the party's future vice presidential candidate, John Edwards. Future Senate leaders Harry Reid and Chuck Schumer supported the resolution. not to mention numerous future committee chairs like Dianne Feinstein. It was good politics for Democrats to support the war in Iraq, even within their own party. Outside the Congress, relatively few mainstream liberals pushed back. Many aggressively supported the invasion. In 2002, the New York Times gave the case for war a sizable boost with a series of stories on Iraq's supposedly vibrant chemical and biological weapons programs. The article cited anonymous Bush administration sources who later went on television and cited the Times as evidence that what they already told the paper on background was true. It was an airtight loop. Strikingly, two of the Times reporters responsible for those stories had previously written books attacking Saddam Hussein. It's not a defense of the Iraqi regime to wonder how that might have affected their objectivity. Would the New York Times allow reporters who'd written books critical of abortion to cover the Supreme Court's reevaluation of Roe versus Wade? Probably not, though the hypothetical is absurd since almost nobody at the paper opposes abortion. In the end, the Times admitted the desire for war with Iraq clouded judgment in the newsroom. Quote, editors at several levels who should have been challenging reporters and pressing for more skepticism were perhaps too intent on rushing scoops into the paper, read the newspaper's postmortem. Accounts of Iraqi defectors were not always weighed against their strong desire to have Saddam Hussein ousted. It wasn't just the Times. Other establishment outlets did the same, including the Washington Post and the Los Angeles Times. Stories that confirmed the existence of Iraq's WMD program made the front page. Stories that raised doubts got buried. A post-invasion evaluation of coverage by the New York Review of Books concluded this. Despite abundant evidence of the administration's brazen misuse of intelligence, the press repeatedly let officials get away with it. As journalists rushed to chronicle the administration's failings on Iraq, they should pay some attention to their own. They did pay attention, at least for a while. While the initial invasion of Iraq toppled Saddam Hussein from power almost effortlessly, the war quickly became an expensive, bloody quagmire with no clear end objective in sight. U.S. casualties, initially low, spiraled into the thousands. Even worse, Iraq's WMD programs, the core justification for the war, proved to be illusory. The many failures of the Iraq War triggered an Indian summer of anti-war sentiment on the left. In Connecticut, pro-war Senator Joe Lieberman lost his party's nomination in the Democratic primary to anti-war Ned Lamont. Lieberman held the seat running as an independent with strong Republican support. Michael Moore won an Oscar and became one of the left's intellectual leaders for his documentary Fahrenheit 9/11, which took a critical look not only at the Iraq War, but the entire war on terror. Cindy Sheehan, whose son was killed in Iraq, became a household name when she camped outside President Bush's Texas ranch, demanding a personal meeting and an end to the war. Hundreds of thousands of people turned out for anti-war protests in Washington, D.C. and other major American cities. But just as Indian summers eventually give way to winter, the revival of left-wing anti-war activism failed to reverse a long-term trend toward greater enthusiasm for war. When then-Senator Barack Obama ran for president in 2008, he positioned himself as the anti-war candidate. He attacked his top opponent, Hillary Clinton, for supporting the 2002 war resolution and pledged to get U.S. troops out of Iraq. But even this anti-war attitude was a pale shadow of the anti-war positions the left once adopted. McGovern had pledged peace in Vietnam within 90 days. Obama merely vowed to have U.S. combat troops out within 16 months, and he counterbalanced that pledge with a promise to increase troop levels in Afghanistan. Less than a year into his first term, Obama was awarded the Nobel Peace Prize, apparently for the transcendent achievement of not being George W. Bush. But the prize had no lasting effect on Obama. Under his stewardship, the Democratic establishment once again became the party of war, differing from Republicans only on exactly how much war they wanted and where. In 2011, Hillary Clinton and other interventionists in the administration convinced Obama to support the overthrow of Muammar Gaddafi in Libya. It was never obvious why Gaddafi needed to be killed. While he'd once supported terrorist efforts against the West and established nuclear and chemical weapons programs, his behavior had dramatically improved after the invasion of Iraq. He shuttered his WMD programs in December 2003, was removed from America's list of state terror sponsors, and even collaborated with the European Union to block illegal migration from Africa into Europe. Gaddafi was an unsavory autocrat. But there were far more dangerous and more repressive regimes out there, and there was no clear replacement for him within Libya, If there's a single lesson of the Iraq War, it's that chaos is worse than dictatorship. Libya looked like a prime candidate for chaos. With Gaddafi gone, it was obvious that the place might devolve into a lawless mess and become a bug light for extremist groups. Hillary Clinton and Samantha Power of the National Security Council didn't agree. They viewed Gaddafi as a deeply immoral man. That's all the justification they needed to take him out. So they did. With Gaddafi on the brink of victory in the Libyan civil war, the United States and its NATO allies intervened, taking over the country's airspace, bombing Gaddafi's forces, and turning the tide of the conflict. 7 months later, Gaddafi was toppled from power, captured, and unceremoniously killed. The establishment applauded. Obama's overthrow of the Gaddafi government, declared the New York Times, was an historic victory for the people of Libya who, with NATO's help, transformed their country from an international pariah into a nation with the potential to become a productive partner with the West. The paper's triumphant tone evokes another famous Times dispatch from Cambodia in April 1975. The headline, Indochina Without Americans, For Most, A Better Life. That story ran in the paper 4 days before the Khmer Rouge entered Phnom Penh and began murdering more than a third of the country's population. The aftermath in Libya hasn't been quite as bloody, but that's small comfort. Instead of creating a democratic, westernized Libya, Obama's destruction of Gaddafi simply created a new failed state. Rather than marginalizing radical Islam, Gaddafi's fall empowered it. And by 2014, the country was in another civil war that killed thousands. ISIS militants have found a haven in the lawless country. While Gaddafi had blocked illegal migration to Europe, the new Libya has been powerless to stop it, and hundreds of thousands of African migrants have made their way to Europe from Libyan ports. Things got so bad in Libya after Gaddafi was deposed that even the Times had to acknowledge it might be some time before the country could become, quote, a productive partner with the West. Luckily, the Times had a solution, more American intervention in Libya. Remarkably, an editorial in August 2016 cited the very same 2011 disaster the paper once endorsed as a justification for repeating the same mistake. Quote, the United States demonstrated during its involvement in the 2011 civil war that led to the ouster of Colonel Muammar Gaddafi that American airstrikes can change battlefield fortunes. In Washington, military action is assumed to be preferable to inaction, regardless of outcome. Barack Obama, who campaigned for president on the promise to withdraw from Iraq, not only bombed the country, the fourth American president in a row to do so, but by the end of his term had recommitted troops on the ground. Republicans didn't seem to find this odd. Their main complaint was that he sent too few. Liberals, meanwhile, stood by and in some cases cheered as Obama expanded the war on terror beyond the boundaries of the Bush years. After 2 terms, Obama had ordered the killing of nearly 4,000 people by drone attacks, most of them in non-battlefield areas like Yemen, Somalia, and Pakistan. Some of the people killed were American citizens, struck down as enemy combatants, despite being far away from U.S. troops in countries the United States was not at war with. By 2013, the lessons of Iraq and Libya still unlearned, Obama was preparing for another regime change, this time in Syria. The cycle was eerily similar. Syrian President Bashar al-Assad was undoubtedly a cruel authoritarian figure, but he was also not a clear threat to the United States, and it was impossible to know who might replace him should he fall. Nevertheless, following a chemical attack on civilians during the country's civil war, Secretary of State John Kerry gave an impassioned speech about Assad's human rights abuses and argued that a military intervention was needed. A now familiar cycle began again. The New York Times was back with its full support. In an editorial, the paper noted that it would, quote, be highly unlikely, if not irresponsible, for President Obama to authorize Mr. Kerry to speak in such sweeping terms and then do nothing. The next day, the Times ran an opinion piece titled, Bomb Syria, Even If It's Illegal. Strong popular opposition ultimately scuttled Obama's plans to bomb Assad's government, though 7 out of 10 senators who voted for it were Democrats. But it was only a temporary reprieve. Removing Assad from power remained the official policy of the U.S. government. By the end of the Obama years, America was not only bombing Syria, but had ground troops there, this time for the purposes of fighting the Islamic State. And not just there, but a number of other places as well. On Election Day 2016, after 8 years of rule by the nominally anti-war faction of U.S. politics, American troops were stationed on roughly 800 military bases in 70 nations. The Pentagon was dropping bombs on at least 7 different countries. Barack Obama was the first president to serve 2 full terms and preside over a war for every single day of them. Not all of that was Obama's choosing. He didn't start the wars in Iraq or Afghanistan, but he didn't pull back much either. What's particularly striking, however, is how little Democrats said about it. Apart from some rumblings on the far left, there were no protests in the streets. In 2008, 3 anti-war documentaries were nominated for Best Documentary at the Academy Awards, and Hollywood stars routinely bashed President Bush's foreign policy. On January 21st, all of that evaporated. Popular culture seemed oblivious. In 2016, there wasn't a single anti-war song in the top 100 pop hits. Liberals were no longer interested in giving peace a chance. If anything, by the 2016 presidential election, liberals seemed most agitated by the idea of not being in conflict with other countries. In one of those weird historical ironies that almost nobody seemed to appreciate at the time, the Republican in the race was running well to the left of his Democratic opponent on key foreign policy questions. Donald Trump gave speech after speech attacking the wars in Iraq and Afghanistan and the idea of nation building more broadly. Hillary Clinton was still defending the decision to kill Gaddafi. Nowhere was the divide broader or more bewildering than on Russia. Trump argued it would be in America's interest to make common cause with the Russian government when possible, especially in the fight against Islamic extremism. Liberals, who for decades defended Russia when it was run by the Soviets, dismissed the idea out of hand as irresponsible, possibly even unpatriotic. Yet again, the New York Times led the way. 2 days before the 2016 GOP convention in Cleveland, the Times announced that, quote, decades after the end of the Cold War, Moscow, led now by the ambitious, aggressive, and unpredictable Vladimir Putin, has returned as a major threat. The paper would spend the better part of the next year detailing that threat and implicitly suggesting that it deserved a military response. Less than a week after the election, the Times editorial board warned of, quote, the dangers of going soft on Russia. The paper repeatedly described the hacking of the Democratic National Committee's email servers as an act of war by Vladimir Putin. Democrats in Congress and on cable news repeated the charge. Were they serious or just baiting Trump? Both, probably, but more the former than you might expect. At the end of March 2017, the administration indicated it would be ending the Obama-era policy of seeking regime change in Syria. Our priority is no longer to sit and focus on getting Assad out, explained U.S. Ambassador to the United Nations Nikki Haley. The foreign policy establishment responded with outrage. Figures from both parties described the policy change as a concession to Russia, a major backer of the Assad regime, and therefore as a betrayal of the United States. 5 days later, U.S. intelligence agencies announced that the Assad government had dropped chemical weapons on civilians in northern Syria, killing at least 20 children. No one doubted Assad was capable of committing atrocities, but this one seemed counterproductive, to put it mildly. Indeed, it was one of the few things Assad could have done to reverse U.S. policy on removing him from office. Essentially, it was the most effective way to sabotage his all but assured victory in the Syrian civil war. According to American officials, he did it anyway. It didn't make sense. Why would a man as canny and resilient as Bashar al-Assad do something so pointless and self-destructive? Apparently because he was so innately evil he couldn't help himself. That was the explanation from self-described Syria experts in Washington, few of whom could speak Arabic or had ever lived in Syria. Bad people do bad things. Assad is bad. He must go. Within days, the Trump administration caved to the pressure and lobbed missiles into Syria. There were a lot of questions about the move, beginning with, what was the point? If we took out Assad, who would replace him? And by the way, how did we know for certain the Syrian government ordered the chemical attack? Didn't the Syrian rebels have chemical weapons too? Couldn't the decision have been the work of underlings rather than top commanders? For the most part, questions like these went unasked. Instead, for the first time since Trump received the GOP nomination, elites in both parties cheered. The media congratulated the new president for his courage and steadfast leadership. According to a Harvard study, the Syrian missile strike was the only decision Trump made in his first 100 days that received positive press coverage. Even Trump's opponents in Congress loved it. Senator Chuck Schumer, leader of the Senate Democrats, described the attack as the right thing to do. The senior Democrat in the House, Nancy Pelosi, called it a proportional response. Senators Dick Durbin and Elizabeth Warren agreed. Former House Majority Leader Steny Hoyer said his only complaint was that Trump didn't go far enough. For the first time in memory, Democrats in Washington were every bit as hawkish as Republicans. The alignment was complete. How did that happen? The first step for Democrats was embracing violence as a tool of positive social change. In 1965, liberals viewed the bombing of North Vietnam as a moral atrocity. 30 years later, they applauded Bill Clinton's bombing of Bosnia as a means of protecting the rights of a vulnerable minority group, the local Muslim population. Liberals discovered that war was an expedient form of social engineering, not to mention politically popular. Want to save children? Bomb their country. Head Start suddenly seemed like a tepid half-measure compared to these swift, compassionate airstrikes. How often do bombings actually improve people's lives? Do children on the ground really like them? Who knows? Follow-up stories on the aftermath of cruise missile attacks are notably rare in the American media. The practical effects of the policies are less interesting to policymakers in Washington than the spirit in which they're intended. When you're pulling the trigger, the spirit is always pure. Liberals believe that Curtis LeMay dropped bombs because he was a crazed warmonger who took pleasure in hurting people. Liberals believe they bomb countries for the same reasons they once opposed bombing countries, because they want to make the world a better place. Intent is what matters. The second force driving the shift was a change in leadership in America's biggest institutions. Liberal skepticism of the Vietnam War was inseparable from a generalized suspicion of the establishment. The left distrusted the government's rhetoric and goals in the Vietnam War because the left distrusted the government itself. Liberals knew powerful people were happy to lie to them. Liberals now control those elite institutions. They no longer distrust power, they wield it. We were better off with Curtis LeMay. When moral certainty meets indifference to detail, anything can happen. You can overthrow a secular dictator, watch as he's replaced by a bloodthirsty religious nut who makes everything worse, and then attempt the very same thing somewhere else, expecting different results, and never feel bad about it. It's amusing to think that well-educated professionals once considered Lyndon Johnson the world's greatest threat to peace. What they hated most about Johnson was his naked cynicism. That was appalling, but it was far from the worst thing. The most dangerous force of all turns out to be an activist establishment that believes its heart is in the right place. The signature characteristic of America's foreign policy establishment, apart from their foolishness, is the resiliency of their self-esteem. No matter how often they're wrong, no matter how many disasters they unintentionally create, they never seem to feel bad about it. They certainly never blame themselves. Part of the reason for this is that most of them live in Washington. Washington isn't like everywhere else. The city's economy is tied directly to the size of the federal budget, which has grown virtually without pause since the attack on Pearl Harbor in 1941. The District of Columbia and its surrounding suburbs are now the wealthiest metro region in the country. Washington's job market is effectively bulletproof. Political figures cycle in and out of government, from lobbying to finance to contracting and back, growing richer at every turn. In Washington, prosperity is all but guaranteed. To the rest of the country, this looks like corruption, because essentially it is. But if you live there, it's all upside. The most interesting effect of uninterrupted economic growth is that the culture of the city remains unusually stable. Even as Washington's population has grown exponentially over the years, many things about the city haven't changed at all. Most of the affluent neighborhoods look the same demographically as they did in 1960. Mothers don't work, divorce is unusual, housing prices almost never fall. It's a cultural time capsule. By voter registration, D.C. is the most Democratic city in America. And yet the instincts of the people who live there are deeply conservative. Washingtonians hate change. More than anything, they hate to be told they're wrong or their ideas are stupid, especially when they are. This explains much of official Washington's hostility to Donald Trump. It's possible to isolate the precise moment that Trump permanently alienated the Republican establishment in Washington, February 13th, 2016. There was a GOP primary debate that night in Greenville, South Carolina, so every Republican in Washington was watching. Seemingly out of nowhere, Trump articulated something that no party leader had ever said out loud. We should never have been in Iraq, Trump announced, his voice rising. We have destabilized the Middle East. Many in the crowd booed, but Trump kept going. They lied. They said there were weapons of mass destruction. There were none, and they knew there were none. Pandemonium seemed to erupt in the hall and on television. Shocked political analysts declared that the Trump presidential effort had just euthanized itself. Republican voters, they said with certainty, would never accept attacks on policies their party had espoused and carried out. Back in Washington, rival GOP campaigns frantically searched for ways to discredit what Trump had said. They found what they considered a silver bullet in a recording of an episode of the Howard Stern radio show from 2002, in which Trump seemed to approve of the idea of overthrowing Saddam. By Washington standards, this qualified as a kill shot. The candidate had once uttered complimentary words about a war that had not yet started. Therefore, he had no right to criticize the same war 14 years later after it had proved disastrous. Consultants for the Jeb and Marco Rubio campaigns traded high fives. Republican voters had a different reaction. They understood that adults sometimes change their minds based on evidence. They themselves had come to understand that the Iraq War was a mistake. They appreciated hearing something verboten but true. Rival Republicans denounced Trump as an apostate. Voters considered him brave. Trump won the South Carolina primary, and shortly after that, the Republican nomination. Republicans in Washington never recovered. When Trump attacked the Iraq War and questioned the integrity of the people who planned and promoted it, he was attacking them. They hated him for that. Some of them became so angry it distorted their judgment and character. Bill Kristol is probably the most influential Republican strategist of the post-Reagan era. Born in 1954, Kristol was the second child of the writer Irving Kristol, one of the founders of neoconservatism. Like most early neoconservatives, Irving Kristol was a former leftist, a childhood Trotskyite, who became progressively disillusioned with failures of government social policy and with the left's infatuation with the Soviet Union. The neoconservatism of Irving Kristol and his friends was jarring to the ossified liberal establishment of the time, but in retrospect, it was basically a centrist philosophy, pragmatic, tolerant of a limited welfare state, not rigidly ideological. By the time Bill Kristol got done with it 40 years later, neoconservatism was something else entirely. Kristol came to Washington in the mid-1980s to work for the Reagan administration after several years of teaching at Harvard. In 1995, he founded the Weekly Standard. I joined the Standard as a reporter that year, about a month before the magazine launched, and stayed until early 2001. Kristol was in his prime. The publication was explicitly conservative, but most of the time the writers could write what they wanted. I found Kristol a humane and decent boss, if a little cold. He was funny as hell in meetings. What I didn't understand at the time was that Kristol had an unstated agenda that informed much of what the Weekly Standard did. The writers in the office thought we were engaged in conservative journalism. Kristol was trying to remake the Republican Party. Years later, writer Philip Weiss described a conversation he had with Kristol in which this became explicit. There are Republicans, Kristol told Weiss, of whom I disapprove so much that I won't appear with them, that I've encouraged that they be expelled or not welcomed into the Republican Party. I'd be happy if Ron Paul left and ran as a third-party candidate. I was very happy when Pat Buchanan was allowed to go off and run as a third-party candidate. Unbeknownst to his staff, Bill Kristol had no intention of being merely a magazine publisher or a disseminator of conservative ideas. He saw himself as the ideological gatekeeper of the Republican Party. I wish I'd known this when I worked there. Kristol was always encouraging me to write hit pieces on Pat Buchanan, and on a couple of occasions I did. At the time, I had no idea that this was part of a larger strategy, though it did strike me as a little odd. In one of those coincidences that happen regularly in a city as small as Washington, Pat Buchanan's sister, Kathleen, was Kristol's assistant at the Standard and well-liked by everybody. Buchanan himself was an appealing guy, personally, beloved by the people around him. And his politics weren't entirely crazy. A lot of what Buchanan predicted in the 1990s turned out to be true. The animus wasn't personal. Kristol got along with Buchanan when they saw each other. Kristol didn't even disagree with most of Buchanan's views on social questions. In private, Kristol was as witheringly anti-gay as Buchanan was in public. The disagreement was entirely over foreign policy. At his core, that's what Crystal cared about. That's why he despised figures as seemingly disconnected as Pat Buchanan and Ron Paul. One of the few things Paul and Buchanan had in common was opposition to more war in the Middle East. Crystal believed the United States should be bombing and invading countries throughout the region. Almost from the moment Operation Desert Storm concluded in 1991, Crystal began pushing for an overthrow.